began in the autumn of 1975 when the body of a prostitute was found on waste ground in the city of Leeds in the north of England. Her name was Wilma McCann, and she had been savagely beaten to death. Over the next 4 years, 12 more women were murdered, some of them prostitutes, some not. The hunt for the murderer of these women became the biggest and most complex criminal investigation ever mounted in Britain. The police were looking for a man who became known as the Yorkshire Ripper, but he defied all their efforts, and a reign of terror gripped the towns and cities of northeast England until the 3rd of January 1981, when a man called Peter Sutcliffe was arrested and charged with the murders. His capture had little to do with the £4 million investigation set up to apprehend him, because he was arrested by two policemen on the beat who found him with a prostitute and noticed that he had a false index plate on his car. Sutcliffe confessed to the murders. The judge was not prepared to accept a plea of insanity, and all of the horrific acts perpetrated on his victims by the Ripper were described in court. His favorite weapons have been a heavy Klein hammer and a sharpened screwdriver. Peter Sutcliffe was sentenced to a minimum of 30 years imprisonment, but he has since been moved to Broadmoor because of his mental condition. After the Ripper case, the full extent of the foul-ups, overlooked clues, and false assumptions made by the police came to light. Of major concern was the taped message, supposedly from the Ripper, that had been a central part of the authorities' attempts to identify the murderer. It was played on radio and television at the time. This is what it sounded like.
I'm not quite sure when I start again, but he will be definitely sometime this year, maybe September, October, even soon. I think I'll get a chance. At the rate I'm going, I should be in the Dugger Records. I think it's 11 now, isn't it? Well, I'll keep on going for quite a while yet. I can't see myself being nicked just yet.
Have you heard that voice before? At work? Or in a pub? Club? On a bus? Or in a queue? Think. Do you know somebody with a northeastern accent like that who lives in the Leeds, Bradford, Manchester, Preston, Halifax, or Huddersfield areas? Or who travels there from your area? If so, phone your local police.
The police were convinced that this man was the Yorkshire Ripper and built their investigation around this tape and some letters that had been posted to them. It was not the voice of Peter Sutcliffe. There were many other discrepancies in the Ripper case, but when Sutcliffe was put away by the police and the public closed the Ripper file, believing the mass murderer had been caught. But had he been? One man who believes that the real Yorkshire Ripper is still at large is Noel O'Gara, an Irish man who for several years has almost single-handedly tried to convince the authorities that he knows the identity of the real Ripper, that the Ripper is an Irishman, well known to him and them, and that they are ignoring substantial evidence that he can provide. Noel O'Gara is here with me in the studio this morning. Good morning to you, Noel.
Good morning, Jerry.
Right, an extraordinary tale. For many people, the Ripper story is now a bad memory from a long time ago, 1981. You have spent since that time an awful amount of energy, probably a reasonable amount of money, in trying to prove that the man who actually committed quite a substantial number of the murders that were attributed to Peter Sutcliffe is still at large, and that that man, in fact, is an Irish man. Can you tell us how the story began?
Well, yes, Jerry. The reason why I'm telling this story and why I'm here in the studio now is very simply because I'm the man who identified the Yorkshire Ripper in 1979 at the height of this publicity campaign, where the police were begging everyone. They knew the Ripper's voice, they knew his handwriting, they knew practically everything about him. And there was a huge publicity campaign in 1979 because of the fact that the murderer, whoever the Ripper was, it was the biggest manhunt ever mounted in British criminal history. more than twice as many murders as Jack the Ripper 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And all committed over a wide area in Leeds, Bradford, Halifax, Huddersfield, Preston, Manchester. So they knew, the police knew that they were faced with a huge and daunting task of trying to find this man, and they had so many clues to his identity. He was taunting them by his letters and his tape recordings, because he knew that they'd never get him. He was an experienced, devious, cunning, evil criminal. And I had the
How did you identify this man?
In November 1979, as part of this publicity campaign, I happened to be reading a newspaper article at home, just like you might read the paper at night, a large psychological profile of the Yorkshire Ripper. And I made the terrifying discovery that this man, who had been a former employee of mine, whom I can't name on your program, but he's an Irish man.
We call him Mr. X.
Mr. X, right. I just knew it was him.
Right, so during all this publicity, during all the attempts by the police and the authorities to identify this man or help the public identify him, you are sitting here in Ireland.
Right.
You have this gentleman working for you, a Mr. X, right? You read the psychological profile, you read the details of the murders, and you identify this man who works for you as the Yorkshire Ripper.
From the things that were said about him in the paper, in that paper article, it was a detailed psychological profile.
Okay, right. Now, tell us how they described him.
Okay, well, the man that I knew, first and foremost, had a long, dangerous criminal record in England. He was Category A criminal, the worst type, only to be approached with extreme caution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't know very much about his previous criminal record, but I knew that he was an evil psychopath. He had been diagnosed in English prisons as an aggressive psychopath. He told me that himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that doesn't make him the Ripper, of course. But I knew also he was a sex maniac of the most alarming descriptions, and I'm not going to try and frighten the listeners by telling them some of the exploits that I witnessed.
That you actually witnessed, heard about.
That I know took place, you know, and I can substantiate many, many of them, and many people in the town he comes from, in Clara County, Offaly, everyone would give you different stories about him. He's well known, a well known blackguard. In the last few years, a lot more talk has gone on about him, and that these things are coming to light. Because people don't like talking. If you're intimidated and battered or beaten or sexually assaulted by some blackguard, it's a thing you don't like to talk about.
Okay, so you're building up this psychological profile of your own, this man who's come to work for you, and from your knowledge and experience of the man, you establish that he is psychopathic.
Okay.
You find out that he's lived in England,
right,
and that the English police are looking for him.
Well, there's a lot more to it, Jerry. I just knew it was him, right? I travelled, without putting the cart before the horse, I travelled over to Manchester and tipped off the Ripper Squad, right? And they got the information. The reason I travelled over was I was too terrified to phone them up, because I mightn't get through the right information or get to the right man, or someone might make a mess of it. But I made sure I got to the right man because I knew it was him. And everything that has happened since, in the 10 years since this publicity campaign, it's now 10 years since it happened, has proved beyond all doubt that I'm right. And what I'm...
Now, you must obviously have worked out a time scale, though, because if this man who works for you was working with you in Ireland, and he was with you all the time, obviously he could not have been over in England committing the murders.
Oh, no. He commuted to do most of them, in fact.
And these times that he was absent from your employment were the times when these Ripper murders had been committed?
No. In the time, these things fitted in. The timing fitted in, according to this newspaper article, fitted in exactly with the time he came into my employment and when he was leaving it again. And the following summer, he bought this tape recorder, and he used to go to the north of Ireland, Jonesboro, to buy these records, the Andrew Gold record, that he's played a snatch of that on with the tape, the Geordie tape. Naturally, he wasn't going to use an Irish accent, or he'd be saying, come on over, lads, I'm here. You know, the Ripper, he didn't intend to get caught. There was no way he intended to get caught.
Okay, just hold it there for a moment, because we're going to take a break. The number to dial is Dublin 830-222.
Hello, Kat.
Good morning, Noel O'Gara, and we're talking about the Yorkshire Ripper case. And the startling suggestions made by Mr. O'Gara over the last few years, which we're putting to you this morning here on the G. Ryan Show, that, in actual fact, the man convicted in 1981 for all the known Ripper killings in the north of England, Peter Sutcliffe, was not actually the Yorkshire Ripper, that he was not actually responsible for all those killings, and that, in actual fact, a man who lived in Ireland and indeed was at one time in the employment of Noel O'Gara was actually responsible for quite a number of the killings which were eventually attributed to Peter Sutcliffe, and that man is still at large. Right, okay, we've talked about why you thought Mr. X, who worked for you in Clara, was responsible for some of these killings. You've told us you believe that he had the time to go and carry out these killings because at times which corresponded to the murders, he would slip away from right. Ireland. He was, in your opinion, psychopathic, dangerous, violent, sex maniac. According to the British police, he was also very, very dangerous to be approached with caution. He had a criminal record in the UK. Now, you take the story up now, Noel, as far as the evidence is concerned and the problems with that evidence.
Right, well, Blakey in Ireland, who's listening to me now, is the real evidence in the case that was never presented by the police in Yorkshire to the public. There was two vital clues known about the Ripper, who used to select these innocent women at large and at random and batter them over the head with a hammer, drag them into a dark corner if he wasn't already in a corner with them, and he would sexually assault them in many cases, then mutilate their bodies in the most horrific ways that I won't describe, redress them in many cases, and prop them up so that the police would find them and the police would get sick when they see what they've uncovered, eventually, when they would ultimately find them. Now, the police found semen in a number of the bodies, and semen will yield blood grouping.
Right.
So the police in West Yorkshire knew, and this was the main clue that they had, that they knew it was the Ripper again every time, combined with his letters, when his letters he'd promise another murder and deliver on them. And nobody knew about those letters until they published them in 1979. So there were no hoax. Now, they knew that the Ripper was the rare 1 in 16 B blood group. 1 in 16. So if you, Gerry Ryan, became a Ripper suspect because your car was seen in the red light district of Leeds a number of times or whatever,
yeah,
just like Sutcliffe's was, okay, you're brought down to the police station, and the first thing they do with you is take a sample of your blood, check it. If you're anything other than B blood, you're out the door, you couldn't be the Ripper.
Right.
And the second major clue they had was the bite marks. They had your teeth marks, the Ripper's teeth. He used to bite, he bit two of the victims, at least, deeply on the breast. Again, not to give himself a sexual kick or anything like that, but to leave his trademark, mm-hmm, so the police knew it was him again.
Right.
Now, this teeth mark revealed that he had a large gap, which would indicate that he wore dentures in the top two front teeth. When dentures were removed, the gap was there.
Right.
So they knew also the saliva. They knew the track of his teeth, and from the saliva around the tooth bite, again, they had the blood group. Right?
So they were categorically able to identify...
If they got him into the station, they'd know who he was.
If they'd got him into the station, right.
Yeah.
And what blood group was that?
B blood.
B.
1 in 16.
Okay.
Now, Peter Sutcliffe, it was admitted by the police after his conviction. He had never had a trial. Bear in mind, Sutcliffe never had a trial. He only had a test of his sanity to determine whether they would accept the plea of guilty with diminished responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But... So it was revealed that Sutcliffe had already been known to the West Yorkshire police, and in fact that he had been interviewed by them no less than a dozen times. And not only was he interviewed by them, these are the cream of the British Ripper Squad in Bradford, the guys who were charged with doing the job of eliminating Ripper suspects. And they had eliminated Sutcliffe a dozen times because he's O blood group and he's not the Ripper, and they're the guys that proved that Sutcliffe is not the Ripper, not Noel O'Gara.
So the reason that they, having interviewed him on quite a number of occasions, having met him on quite a number of occasions, the reason that they decided that he was not the Ripper was because he was just quite simply the wrong blood group.
The wrong man, yeah. He hadn't the teeth nor the blood. They knew he couldn't have done those murders. But, you see, Sutcliffe had actually, in his disturbed state of mind, committed four murders.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why the Ripper wrote the police the letters and the tape recording to include Sutcliffe's four murders with his own count.
Right.
And And that's why he kept being eliminated. And he really wanted to be caught. He was doing his best to be caught. And when ultimately they couldn't get their hands on the Irishman because he was over in Ireland, they were waiting for him to go over there. They couldn't arrest him down in Clara County, Offaly.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, Sutcliffe got arrested over in Yorkshire 6 weeks after his last murder. And they were looking for a man identical to his description, a bearded man that was seen hanging around the area. And they knew him because they had already identified him and eliminated him a dozen times. And when he was arrested in Sheffield police station, which is away from the West Yorkshire area, the first thing that when the Sheffield police rang up the West Yorkshire police, they says, no, we know him. It's not, he's not the Ripper Lamb of. They didn't want him. They were waiting to get their hands on this little Irishman. And I'm the man that can now tell the story because I'm the man who identified the real Ripper in the first place. And I could therefore see when Sutcliffe came along on the scene that Sutcliffe was not the Ripper.
It was a red herring, despite the fact that he had actually committed 4 murders.
Exactly.
But these were not Ripper murders.
He was the copycat. The police, I've shown you, Jerry.
Let's just get that straight now. You're saying that Sutcliffe's murders were the copycat murders.
That's right.
Of the Irish Ripper murders.
Yeah.
Right.
There was two men's murders mixed up. The police admitted that there was a copycat Ripper at large. They knew that after Sutcliffe's second victim was discovered.
Right.
And that was quite clearly on the record.
Okay.
By the police Ripper Squad. Mm. And what I'm saying to you, Jerry, and to the people listening to me now who had to suffer the trauma and all the fear of this, was that ultimately when the police couldn't get their hands on the real Ripper, who had also sent them the letters and the tape recording, they settled to close the slate, wipe everything off, by offering this disturbed man, Peter Sutcliffe, 10 years in a luxury mental home if he would plead guilty to everything, and he was guaranteed that he wouldn't have to stand trial and that he might get out of the mental home in 10 years, and he had a choice of either doing that or going to jail for life in the harsh regime in jail in Parkhurst, Isle of Wight, where he would be a terribly hard regime. Naturally, for one of his murders alone, he could have got life in jail for that. But he agreed to say, I done them all in exchange for this deal. And I have Mr. John Sutcliffe, Peter Sutcliffe's father, sitting here beside me now in the studio.
Good morning, John.
He will confirm what I'm saying.
Okay, I'll just move this.
Welcome to Ireland, John, and I'd like to thank you for coming over to help me in my campaign.
Great pleasure. Great pleasure to come and help you, Noel. Now, I've been in touch with Noel for by letter for most of 5 years, and personally for the last 3 on about 4 occasions, and I firmly believe that Noel has a very solid case.
And what do you base that on, John?
On the you haven't yet mentioned the fact that Noel has put his story on tape and that I've listened to these tapes. All his evidence is collated on those 4 tapes. It's 6 hours listening, and I've listened to all that. I've listened to Noel's explanations of why he started this campaign against this man,
Mr. X,
whom he knows personally and is apparently employed in the past. Now, I'd also like to say now to all you listeners that I know, categorically, I know that my son did not do all the murders.
How do you know that, John?
I've heard, by word of mouth, he's told us that he didn't do them all.
How did he explain that to you?
Well, in the first instance, he said to his two brothers and me when we visited him, when he was on remand, he said, you know, I didn't do them all. Right. In his solicitor's office, whilst he was on remand, I was told by his solicitor, Mr. Curry McGill, that Peter would not go for trial. He'd admitted to all the offences that had been put before him.
He was going to plead guilty to everything.
He was going to plead guilty to everything.
And normally,
exactly.
And normally there would not be a trial.
And there would not be a trial. That there was a place for him in the Liverpool Park Lane mental home.
Right. John Sutcliffe, I'm going to stop you there for just one moment. We're going to be back in just a few moments after these.
My phone rang.
Radio until midday in the studio this morning. I have Noel O'Gara, the man who firmly believes that the real Yorkshire Ripper is still at large. Not only is he still at large, but he was an Irishman and still is an Irishman. And with Noel O'Gara in the studio, we have Peter Sutcliffe's father, John Sutcliffe. Right, John, before the break there, you were telling me how during Peter's remand, you and his brothers visited him and he told you that he was not responsible for all the murders. That he had agreed to plead guilty to all the murders that they presented to him, and that your solicitor, his solicitor, reckoned that he wasn't going to go to trial, that a deal had been done.
Yes, that's all very true. Now, the deal must have been worked out between the police and the legal people, and eventually, when Mr. Justice Boreham was put in charge of the court proceedings, he demanded that there be a trial at the Old Bailey, which wasn't part of the original agreement. So it was arraigned there, and during that trial, no lesser person than the Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers, actually pleaded Peter's case for him and tried to get him sent to a mental home. Now, as you all know, he was found guilty and sent to prison. And then eventually he was removed from prison and sent to the Broadmoor Institution in Berkshire. Now, on the strength of Mr. Agara's story, in which I have a great deal of faith, I would like to see an independent inquiry, not by the police, but by some responsible body. And that inquiry should be based on Mr. Agara's evidence. And to make it plain to the world at large that my son was not the true Yorkshire Ripper.
Though you do agree, and you can testify to us this morning, that he was responsible for a number of murders.
I can indeed. I have a letter in my bureau at home, in his own handwriting, where he actually admits to four of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't get him to admit to any more. And also in the same letter, it repeats what he told us when he was on remand in Leeds prison. It's quite true, I didn't do them all.
Right, okay, back to Noel O'Gara and the evidence here. Thank you, John. Noel, the evidence that you gathered over the years, your assumptions based on your deep analysis of the situation, and that analysis, of course, eventually resulting in a firm belief that Peter Sutcliffe was not responsible for all the Ripper murders, that the man who was in your employment at the time, the early 80s, late 70s, was actually, in your opinion, responsible for these murders. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about that evidence and how you presented it to the British police and what their reaction was?
Yes, well, what I'd like to tell the people listening to me and make it quite clear is that there is a police cover-up. It's as simple as that. And the problem for me, and not just for me, but for the innocent public who are still at risk from the Ripper, is that the police will never admit to making a mistake. Now, I have a list here, Jerry. It runs to practically 50 names of serving police officers who were involved in the Ripper investigation.
In the United Kingdom?
In England. Almost to a man, they have resigned or retired. In fact, the two chief constables...
Is it not possible, though, that they were at that stage of their career? I mean, what do you read into that?
Possibly some of them, but I have... My allegations were first published in England in 1983, May 1983, exactly 1 week after... These very same allegations that I'm making to you and through you to the people listening to me now, They won't change. The women have been murdered. Nothing will change. You know, it's all on the record. 1 week later, the chief constable of West Yorkshire, Ronald Gregory, resigned from the force. And a couple of weeks after that, the two other assistant chief constables resigned, George Oldfield and Jim Hobson, who had been in charge of the case at the time of Peter Sutcliffe's conviction. So what I'm saying is that they will never admit, and I have frequently challenged them over the years, to come on any television or any radio or any independent thing and argue the case with me, but they won't do it. They've all resigned. Because they know they've got the wrong man.
Okay, right. And you reckon that you've got the right man. Now, there are people listening this morning saying, left when the murders were committed over in the UK. So he was a violent, psychopathic kind of a character and had a history of violence and criminal activity. So the British police wanted him. That doesn't make him the Yorkshire Ripper. Did he actually ever admit to you, either directly or indirectly, that he may have been responsible for any of these murders?
Well, I have, as John said, I have published my story on a set of cassette tapes. And the reason I've done that is because I didn't expect, nor do I even expect now, the authorities in England to reopen the case, because it's too much of a can of worms for them. Because they're the ones that are guilty of gross criminal negligence. But I have published my story to the public because I believe the public have a right to know, because they were the victims, and still are. Mm. And some of the evidence that I have, all of it is contained in the tapes, and you've heard them yourself, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And
these are tapes containing extraordinary phone calls between Mr. X and Noel O'Gara himself, violence being threatened, phone calls regarding the Garda Síochána, more violence being threatened. Violence the whole way through these tapes.
That's what we're talking about.
There's no doubt about that. But what I want to know is that, in specific terms, in relation to the actual Ripper murders, as they happened and as they're tabulated in the United Kingdom, did Mr. X at any time directly or indirectly indicate to you that he was responsible for these murders?
Oh, yes. I have him actually on the tapes where he admits to the murders. But he done that in 1983. And, of course, he knew damn well that, as he often says to me, he says, no, the law is not just made for the criminals, it's made for the police too. The police have to go by the law and the rules of law. And that's what it's all about. He's a devious criminal.
So let's put that on the record, Noel. Mr. X, right, actually said to you, and you have it on tape, and it can be listened to. I have the tape here. It's the real Yorkshire Ripper revealed. On these tapes here, we have Mr. X, who's actually named on the tapes. We have him saying categorically to you that he carried out these killings, and that we can identify by listening to these tapes that he is definitely talking about the correct killing.
Correct.
Did he go into details with you?
Oh, yes, in great detail. But I think the most important point to point out, first of all, when I told the police in 1979, November 1979, at the height of the publicity campaign, a year later, Peter Sutcliffe was arrested. 6 months later, after a long remand, he was convicted. As I say, he never had a trial because he willingly pleaded guilty and gave them a statement and a story for everything as part of his deal. He wasn't allowed then to appeal it. His appeal was turned down. And he was stuck in for life into jail. Now, I had the conviction in my mind that Sutcliffe was not the Ripper. I thought at first that he had fooled the police.
Mm.
I had to set out and go to England, go to the libraries and find out all the information, all the evidence, and read all the books. There was 5 books written about the Ripper. And I discovered that, in actual fact, the police were looking for a stocky, bearded Irishman as the number one Ripper suspect for years. From the first...
How did you discover that? Where did you get that information from?
From newspaper cuttings in the Daily Mirror in 1976.
Mm.
There's a picture of an identikit police photo fit, mm-hmm, of the man they were looking for. Now, you're looking at that, Jerry, and mm-hmm, you're also looking at a photograph of Mr. X.
They look remarkably similar.
Now, in addition, they
have
knew...
Have you received any information from the authorities in mainland England, from the police authorities, to say that they were actually looking for a bearded, stocky,
yes,
Irishman?
Yes, there is actually a police report on the record. It was published in David Yalop's book, the original police report, where they were looking for this stocky, bearded Irishman, who was known to have tattoos and scars and wear gold rings and had a gap in his teeth. Now, my man has all these attributes or credentials, as the local sergeant in Clara says to me over the phone. He has all the credentials now.
Okay, that's where we're going to leave it for just a moment. Back after these.
In a country like ours...
Here this morning we have Noel O'Gara, a man, an Irishman, firmly convinced that the real Yorkshire Ripper is still at large and that Peter Sutcliffe, while he was responsible for a number of murders in the north of England, was not actually responsible for all the murders which he actually eventually confessed to. And we also have Peter Sutcliffe's father here with us this morning, John Sutcliffe. Right, just leaving the Mr. X story and the Irish connection just for one moment. John, have you recently... Yes, thank you very much for moving that right. Have you recently talked to your son, Peter?
No, I haven't spoken to him for... quite some time now, but I do keep in touch with him by letter fairly regularly.
What sort of state of mind would you say he is in at the moment?
Well, he's coping extremely well with his position. He always was an outwardly going, happy type of person. And I think I think he's carried that through to the present day. And he's still making the best of a bad job.
Now, four murders he admitted to you and to his brothers. Four fairly horrific acts of violence. Do you believe personally that do you believe that these were quite simply and quite horrifically four criminal acts?
Well, it stands to reason that he is psychologically disturbed. He must be, to do things like that. And not give any indication to any of us that he was doing those sort of things. It was a terrific shock to the whole family when he was arrested.
Do you think psychologically he was capable of actually carrying out the number of murders which he eventually admitted to?
I wouldn't know... in depth, whether he was capable of committing them all. I just know that he has stated that he did not commit them all.
And as his father, you obviously know him quite well. Do you believe?
I believe.
Good feeling.
I believe absolutely that he's speaking the truth.
Okay. Right.
And I can base that on the statement that his solicitor made, that he wouldn't go to trial. But he was going to plead guilty to all the charges against him, and that he wouldn't go to trial.
So then, quite obviously, Justice Boreham's pronouncement that this was not going to be quite simply a situation where the defendant could plead guilty and slip off to a mental institution.
That's right. That
must have come as a great shock.
Yes, but there was a man who went against the whole of the arrangements that had been made. He did his own thing in the end. And that's how he came to stand trial at the Old Bailey and be convicted on all the counts.
Okay, right. Noel,
but
back to you.
It's important to emphasise that trial was purely a test of his sanity. Isn't that correct, John? A test of sanity.
It was a test of sanity. And in the end of the trial... he was found not to be insane and sent to prison. If he had been found insane at the trial, he would have probably been sent to Broadmoor or whatever straight away.
Now, the phones are hopping now at the moment, and the major question that's being asked is why, if Mr. X is still on the loose, if Mr. X was the man who was in your employment and slipped away to England at the time of these murders, and who, in your opinion, is absolutely and utterly... a certainty for the killings. Why have not more murders been committed since Peter Sutcliffe was put on trial and eventually put away?
Well, the answer to that is very simple, Jerry. The murders haven't stopped. No way have the murders stopped. The only thing that has stopped is the police in England cannot say that the Ripper done it again because they're supposed to have him locked up. On the anniversary of Peter Sutcliffe's conviction, this man travelled over to Manchester and in a town called Congleton, just outside Manchester. He selected out a young 15-year-old girl, murdered her brutally. I won't go into the full details, but he bit her on the breast 15 times. And she was his 15th victim
Now, you have a gigantic file here with you at the moment. Now, without going into the details of specific murders, do you believe, going through the details of each of these cases, that we have a situation where similar or very like murders have taken place since 1981,
yes.
which would dovetail in with the type of killings that Mr. X...
Of course. Well, do you think a man like that is going to hang his hammer up?
Okay.
No way. He's a free man.
Now, and we're going to take a quick call before
and
we finish.
He's still a free man. Now, he's absconded from Ireland. He's a warrant for his arrest in Ireland, issued by Tullamore Circuit Court, on a very serious charge where he attacked three men with a Stanley knife in Clara County, Offaly. And he's wanted on that. And he's believed to be in England at the present moment. And I can't say he'd done any murder. If there was a murder tonight, I can't. But I can say one thing for sure. There will be more murders. You mark my words.
Okay, right. Stick on your headphones there, because we're going to round up this morning's rather extraordinary conversations with the phone call from... Right. What have you got for us?
Well, Jerry, I'll tell you, I agree with a lot of things being said there. There will, of course, be more murders, you know. You will always get imitations like the Hungerford massacre and then the poor fellow there up in Newcastle-on-Tyne who did a similar thing. These events will always occur, you know. The only thing I will say is that I lived in Halifax in Yorkshire around the time in the late 70s and around the time of the incident involving Peter Sutcliffe.
Right.
All the murders, basically all the murders that were committed were on of a prostitution nature. That was the type of victim he would go for.
Mm-hmm.
The poor girl in Halifax, unfortunately, was walking home from her granny's. She didn't live very far away from where I lived, and she came from the best of families, and that, unfortunately, was just one of those things. But I will say that if your man there, Noel, and some of his comments are valid, if he knows and he has given these details, why haven't the details been acted on, as much as this man can't escape forever if he is around, you know? He has to be found with him back from Spain, if necessary.
I gather that you were actually questioned by police.
I was, actually, Jerry. I'll tell you, the funny incident, a very good friend of mine who was going out with a nurse at the time, and in confidence, the nurse gave him the details on some of the injuries regarding poor Josephine Whittaker.
Yeah.
And he more or less told us in the pub what had happened and the brutality of it. And later on, I was joined by my brother, and I related to my brother the injuries which this friend of ours had told me about, you know.
Yeah.
And this conversation, although quiet as it was being listened into by off-duty police officers.
Right.
And I myself was interviewed later. And in fact, I had some of the credentials of the Yorkshire Ripper, because I was short and stocky, I had a beard, and I wore gold rings. And one of the exonerating things that I found at the time, and in fact, it was a CID officer who I knew very well because he'd gone to school with my brother. One of the things that I was exonerated on, and I'd like you to ask Mr. Sutcliffe there, perhaps, did his son have dentures or did his son have false teeth? Because I have dentures, and when this was brought out in the conversation, the fact that I was being questioned was only the fact that I had mentioned in the pub how it occurred. I didn't have any, there was no reason to be asked other than that.
Okay, Tom, thanks for that. Right, now, two questions quickly there, which have to be answered in the space of a minute. One, why aren't the police acting on the information?
Well, Tom, first of all, Tom said he had some of the credentials, but my man had all of the credentials. That's the first thing. The police can't act on the information, quite simply because there's a cover-up, and they can't turn around and tell the public in Britain now that they got the wrong man. They'd all be in serious trouble themselves.
Okay, final word from you, John Sutcliffe.
Right, well, in reply to that gentleman's question, my son has no dentures whatsoever. He has a slight gap between his two front teeth, a natural gap, but it's only a small one. But he has no dentures whatsoever.
And finally, of course, in your campaign and in your work with Noel O'Gara, which I gather will continue, you're not looking for your son to be released. All you're looking for is...
Not at all. He's admitted to four murders. If he'd done one, it would be more than sufficient for him to be put away, as I would say to anyone, about anyone who'd killed anyone. But it rankles with me that the police can shift 7-8 murders onto somebody like that just to clear their books.
Right. Noel O'Gara, John Sutcliffe, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
From me and them, until then, that's 9 o'clock tomorrow on 2FM. Good morning to you. Who gives you more?